neatly cropped with weekly haircuts. Reese knew he shaved twice a day, a habit he had picked up from his father, a financier of the old school. "Sir, if you want me read in on this program because it will help me find Freddy's killer, I'm in." "On ASD-SOLIC? My gut says no."
"At least think about it."
"I'll think about it." "That's all a president can ask. Ahila will be here tomorrow to take you to Andrews, where a plane will be waiting to take you to Texas." "Lackland?" "You'll find out more tomorrow. Trust me, Reese."
"I do, sir."
There was another reason the president wanted Reese read in, one he had not shared. They finished their drinks and the president bid Reese good night, unsure if he had just signed his friend's death warrant. Chapter 10. Andrews Air Force Base, Maryland. The Super Huey touched down at Andrews Air Force Base just after 10 o'clock a.m. A black Suburban was waiting and drove Reese to a VIP section of the airfield. It stopped at the ramp of a Gulfstream G550.
"This me?" Reese asked, sizing up the plane and comparing it to a similar model parked not far away.
"This is you," the driver confirmed.
"Thanks for the lift," Reese said, grabbing his Sitka Drifter travel pack from the seat beside him and exiting the vehicle. Reese paused at the base of the stairs leading into the sleek aircraft. The G550 had a different paint scheme than its relative parked nearby, where the other plane was painted a two-tone white and blue with clear Air Force markings on the Rolls-Royce BR-710 engines, an American flag on the tail, and United States of America printed in large letters just above the distinctive oval windows unique to Gulfstream. Reese's aircraft had no such markings. It was white with a simple gold stripe running the length of the plane beneath the windows. Reese noted that it did have a tail number. Not having one would have made it stand out. In this case, it belonged to the 89th Airlift Wing, a United States Air Force command responsible for executing the Special Air Mission, meaning they were tasked with air transportation for the President and Vice President. A man stuck his head out from the open door.
"Mr. Donovan?"
He descended the stairs with an agility that didn't seem to match his age, which Reese put in the mid-50s range. He extended his hand.
"Tim David, Lieutenant General,"
he smiled. His hair was almost all white, with just a few dark specks to betray its original hue. It was longer than regulations allowed, even for the Air Force, and his gray suit and blue tie were devoid of any military linkages. "Well, General, you've got the plane and the suit, so I'm guessing you know who I am."
"Yes, we might as well dispense with the alias," he said.
"I'm James Reese."
"Nice to meet you, Commander."
"I'm retired," Reese said.
"As I understand it, you have a new vocation, which is why we are going on this flight."
"It's temporary."
"I see. Well, let's get to it. May I take your bag?"
"Are you sure you're a general?"
"That's what they keep telling me."
"Where are all your aides and the majors to make you coffee?"
"It is just us, Mr. Reese."
"Reese works fine."
"All right, Reese. It's just you and me. I'll tell you more when we get airborne. This plane has some unique features that make our conversations more secure in the air."
"More secure? What is it, a flying skiff?" Reese asked, referring to areas designed as sensitive compartmented information facilities, where classified information could be discussed.
"As you will find out, not much is actually secure these days."
To Reese's questioning look, the general said,
"It will make more sense later. Climb aboard, and I'll explain what I can."
Reese boarded the jet and settled into a large leather lounge chair. The cabin door to the cockpit was closed, and there was no one else on board.
"No flight attendants?"
"You sure you're not a Marine?" The general laughed. He pulled the door shut and gave two sharp raps on the cockpit door before taking a seat across from Reese, the aircraft already beginning to taxi.
"We can make some coffee once we're airborne. Honey and cream, right?"
At least you paid attention to the most important intel from my file. The general laughed again. Sir, pardon me, but you just really don't seem like a general.
I'll take that as a compliment.
As the Gulfstream burst through the clouds over Prince George's County, the general unbuckled his belt and moved to a seat with a built-in computer keyboard and monitor. He adjusted the cursor, tapped the trackpad, and after a few keystrokes, seemed satisfied.
Coffee?
Please. The general moved to the galley and poured two cups, mixing honey and cream into one of them before sitting back down across from his guest.
Thank you, sir, Reese said before taking his first sip. Not bad. Okay, it's confirmed. You're Air Force.
That I am. Officially, I'm the Deputy Director of the 16th Air Force's Cyber Division.
Cyber warfare?
That's right. How much of a background do you have in the cyber arena?
Well, I have email, and sometimes I remember my password.
So I should start at the beginning.
That would be helpful. I don't even know what I'm doing here.
And just so we are clear, the general continued, neither do I. But when an executive-level directive comes down from the president, we follow orders, even in the Air Force.
Reese smiled.
This plane is a specially modified Gulfstream G550 C-37B. At altitude, it is about as secure as one can get, which is why we can have this conversation.
Golf courses and G550s. I should have joined the Air Force.
That's how we do it, Reese. You build the golf courses first, and then you go back to Congress and request additional mission essential funds to build the runways. It doesn't work if you start with the runways. That's why the Marines don't have golf courses. They are still figuring it out.
God bless them, Reese said.
Reese, you have undoubtedly heard that cyber warfare is the battleground of the future.
I've been hearing that for as long as I can remember.
Well, it's only partially true. That future, it's been here for a long time. The 16th Air Force was established as the hub of military and intelligence computing supremacy. It is headquartered at Joint Base San Antonio-Lackland in Texas. That's where we are headed. It integrates multi-source intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance cyber warfare with electronic warfare and information operation capabilities. We are preparing for the future, which is actually the right now. Controlling information equates to dominance in cyberspace. What do you know about quantum computing, Reese?
As I am having a hard time deciphering what you just said, please consider me a novice.
Let's see then. Computers work on bits. Basically, heads or tails of a coin. A yes or no answer. Quantum computing uses qubits, which are natural particles.
I think I need a tutor.
Imagine each bit as a marble. As it rolls, at any given point, the answer could be yes, no, or any percentage of either one with an almost infinite number of answers, but done on an atomic scale.
I'm going to nod my head and pretend I understand.
Hang in there with me, Frogman. You'll get it. Admittedly, the nomenclature can be confusing, like atomic entanglement and superposition, but simply put, it all adds up to speed. Time, Reese.
Time, Reese repeated, thinking of his father all those years ago at the Vietnam Veterans Memorial.
That's right, the general continued. The answer that would take years for a computer can be answered in a second or two with a quantum computer. Questions that would take the most advanced computers thousands of years to answer take a quantum computer only minutes. Let's see. How about a military example in terms of incoming intercontinental ballistic missiles? A quantum computer can plot and launch a defensive solution in a second. Compare that to a supercomputer, which might never even get to the initiation of a launch sequence before the inbound warhead hits its target, especially if the missile or missiles are hypersonic.
That makes sense, Reese replied.
With the digital revolution, and the massive amount of information that accumulates on an exponential scale by the second, there is more data for any computer or supercomputer to sift through regardless of what it is doing. It is estimated that 2.5 quadrillion bytes of information are generated daily. That's 2.5 followed by 18 zeros. It is nearly impossible to even comprehend.
That's a lot of zeros, Reese said.
I am sure you have read about government surveillance systems and oversight programs. It's been heavily reported on over the past decade.
I've followed WikiLeaks and Snowden, read his books, and listened to him on Rogan. The general smiled,
as have I. But the Snowden-era surveillance programs that came to light were essentially Atari 2600 level. We are so far beyond that now.
How far? Reese asked.
You will see when we land. My job is just to prime you for what you are about to experience. Why you are being read in, I have no idea. But after today, you will be one of not more than 40 people in government who know.
Know what?
Know what we are capable of.
Reese was beginning to have regrets.
Reese, the best way to describe it is that we can basically see anything, at any time, in any place.
Sir?
Every cell phone, whether it is turned on or off, every text message, regardless of app, every keystroke on every computer, every camera, bank account data, any bit of digital information that exists in the world, we can see it all.
Reese took a breath. What about privacy issues?
That is a separate matter. And why none of what you will see today is allowed to be used in any court or by any law enforcement agency. Too much is at stake.
Now I'm even more confused than I was by the atomic entanglement and superposition lecture.
It's a lot to take in. For a knuckle-dragger? I was going to say for a SEAL.
Reese laughed.
We have nearly complete electronic coverage and collection for most of the globe. There are a few outlying areas in the Baltics, Siberia, Canada, Africa, and South America. But we can specifically target those areas now, and soon we will not have to allocate additional resources to those dark spots, as we call them. With quantum supremacy, the surveillance state will be global.
That's quite a responsibility, Reese observed.
That's quite a capability, the general countered. This interconnectivity allows us to link cameras on Teslas to cell phones to security systems to drones. Until recently, we were only able to store the information in giant data centers, keeping track of what we call the metadata, or simply the tag, locational data, for delayed or later analysis. The sheer volume made it difficult to sort. You are about to meet our newest addition. Quantum computing has become a reality.
Meet a what? You are talking about this thing as if it's human.
The general paused and looked out the window.
That's because... Well, you'll see. You have to experience it to understand.
Experience what? I'm just an operator, a trigger puller.
You are about to be much more than that.
I think you guys have been watching too many sci-fi movies.
Where do you think all this starts, Reese? Submarines, space travel, even flip phones, they were all science fiction at one point.
So, the bottom line is that you have a big computer, and it collects and sifts through data, spying on everyone. Do I have it about right?
If that were the case, more than 40 people would know about it, Reese. Billions of dollars are being spent by governments, namely the United States, Russia, China, and India, in the quest for quantum supremacy. China alone spent $400 billion last year building data centers in the Gobi Desert. Racks of servers. Essentially, massive hard drives.
Are they all collecting like we are?
Not yet. They have yet to solve the stability problems inherent in quantum computing.
You mean physically?
Yes. Quantum computers are a bit unreliable, sensitive to mistakes, unstable, vibration sensitive. Even a minor noise can disrupt the computations.
Are you sure my smart TV isn't one? Every time I sit down to try and watch something on Netflix or Amazon Prime, I get that loading icon that just spins until I want to rip it off the wall and throw it through a window.
It's a throbber, an animated graphical control element.
What is?
The spinning icon you just described.
Now I like it even less.
Reese? The general said, getting back on track. Only in the past 2 years, through a joint Army-Air Force initiative with the University of Massachusetts, were we able to stabilize the error correction problem, which led to groundbreaking leaps forward. We are in new territory, pioneers, pushing boundaries of artificial intelligence that, up to now, have only been dreamed about.
So, China, Russia, and India don't have these yet?
They are still working on the problem, and while they are focused on it, we are growing our cyber warfare capability at a rate unheard of in years past. No one but us has developed HER.
HER?
Quantum Analysis-Based AI. Artificial Intelligence.
Meaning?
Meaning, she can think, learn, and adapt on her own.
You keep saying HER.
It will all make sense soon. I'm not sure why the president wants you to have access, but he does. And while we are still a country with civilian leadership of the military, we carry out the orders of the president.
You mention that like it's a temporary thing, Reese said.
You'll see, Reese. AI will eventually take over how we govern.
I kind of prefer freedom and privacy.
I regret to inform you that privacy is a thing of the past. There is no privacy. Absolutely none. No hiding. No data not reviewed.
What if you turn it off?
Turn it off?
You know, unplug it, reboot, power down, whatever you call it, turn it off.
We are well past that stage.
You mean you can't Control-Alt-Delete this thing? What about when I hear people talk about wiping the servers and starting over?
That may be possible at level 1 and level 2, but not when it comes to the other levels. Not when it comes to HER.
What levels?
I'll leave that for your next brief at Lackland.
I think I'm more confused than when I boarded the plane.
That's understandable, and unfortunately, that's all I can tell you until you're inside. Now, if you'll excuse me, I have some work to do.
The general slid from his seat and returned to the computer, leaving Reese with more questions than answers. Chapter 11. Lackland Air Force Base, San Antonio, Texas. Lackland Air Force Base sits just southeast of the U.S. Route 90 and Interstate 410 interchange in the dead center of San Antonio, a city better known for its river walk and Mexican food. It is bisected by Route 13, and its Gateway Hills golf course occupies a significant portion of the property. It is home to one of the largest Air Force training facilities in the United States and hosts the Wilford Hall Ambulatory Surgical Center, one of the country's four major referral centers for advanced medical care. In more recent years, Lackland had become part of Joint Base San Antonio, home to the 16th Air Force. The Gulfstream touched down on the principal east-west airstrip, but instead of pulling up to the main terminal, it continued south and stopped on a dead-end taxiway.
"It's time," the general said. As he opened the aircraft door, a black Tesla Model X pulled alongside. To Reese's questioning gaze, the general said, "No fuel-powered cells allowed where you are going."
"This is getting stranger by the minute."
"Are you carrying?"
"Yes."
"Please leave it and your pack on the plane," the general instructed. "It will be safe here."
Reese removed his holster and SIG and zipped them inside the backpack, along with his Amtec blade and half-face folder. He kept his Dynamis Combat flathead, just in case. The two rear Falcon Wing doors of the Model X lifted skyward, and Reese and General David climbed inside. "Surprised this thing just doesn't drive itself," Reese said.
"Zero-emission clean energy, Reese. Nuclear power, solar, and wind. These vehicles are the future."
"That may be, but I prefer the nostalgia and character of the trucks I grew up with. This feels almost too sterile."
"That's the point. You'll come around. We all will eventually."
The driver didn't say a word as they passed building after building of tan stucco until they arrived at a newer structure of glass and steel. The granite monument signage out front read, United States Air Force Intelligence Surveillance and Reconnaissance Group Joint Information Operations Warfare Center. It was flanked by a Douglas DC-3 and its military variant, the C-47A Skytrain. Lackland was known for its historical displays.
We were officially commissioned in 2018 and occupy about 300,000 square feet, David said.
They drove past the main entrance and around to the north side.
Service entrance, he explained.
As the Tesla pulled up to a 16-foot-high steel wall, the ladder parted and let the electric vehicle inside. The door dropped abruptly behind them and sealed them into a closed port. Any forward movement was blocked by three large steel circular devices that rose in front of them. They were flanked by thick plexiglass on either side, behind which stood eight security guards carrying M4 rifles.
Serious, Reese observed.
That we are, the Air Force General responded.
The driver opened all the windows as a red laser scanned the top and bottom of the car.
More reliable than dogs or mirrors, he said.
The scan complete, the Tesla's windows moved back into place, and the steel barriers lowered into the ground. The car pulled into a large garage that reminded Reese of the Land Cruiser Heritage Museum he had visited years ago when his SEAL team was conducting hardened site breacher training at Dugway Proving Ground in Utah. Only this museum was empty except for the armed guards on catwalks above them.
This is where I leave you, General David said.
What do you mean? You aren't coming with me?
We limit the number of people who can be around her at one time. Remember, she's very sensitive. Vibrations. Jimmy will take you from here.
Jimmy?
The general pointed to the other side of the garage bay as a large roll-up door slid upward on rails and a golf cart emerged from what looked to Reese like a missile silo. Its clean rubber tires came to a stop with a squeak on the spotless floor in front of the Tesla.
Mr. Donovan, General David said, switching back to Reese's alias. This is Jimmy.
Hi, Jimmy said, stepping from his green electric golf cart and offering Reese an elbow bump instead of a handshake.
In old Birkenstocks, faded blue jeans, and a loud Hawaiian shirt, the new arrival stood out from the uniform-clad guards eyeing them from above. His long, unruly red hair sprang from beneath a fraying Detroit Tigers baseball hat. A shark tooth hung from a leather cord around his neck.
I'll be your tour guide from here. Don't worry, General D. I'll take good care of him. Jimmy may not look like it, but he has doctorates in electrical engineering, quantum physics, and systems engineering.
And a master's in physics, Jimmy chimed in. Don't forget that one.
And a master's in physics, the general repeated. I'll see you when you return.
Return?
Yes, you still have a ways to go.
Shall we, Mr. Donovan?
Jimmy said, gesturing to the golf cart. Reese took a breath. He looked at the Tesla, then at the golf cart, and finally up at the armed guards patrolling the catwalks above. He couldn't remember a time when he'd felt more apprehensive. As much as he didn't like the feeling of driving into the unknown, if whatever was back there could help him find and kill Nizar Khatan, that's exactly where Reese was going.
"Want me to drive?" Reese asked.
"Ah, Mr. Donovan's got jokes. I like it. She'll like it, too. Hop in, Mr. D. I've got your E-ticket ride."
"If you say so," Reese said, climbing into the cart and taking note of the bobblehead hula girl attached to the dash.
"You from Hawaii?"
"No, man. Why do you ask?"
"No reason," Reese said.
Jimmy pulled a U-turn that threatened to dump Reese out of the cart, the rubber wheels squealing on the clean surface of the hangar as the electric vehicle straightened out and disappeared into the tunnel. Chapter 12.
"We've got a bit of a ride," Jimmy said. "It's about 2 miles in."
"In or down?" Reese asked, noticing that the path taking them to the inner sanctum of U.S. cyber warfare was also taking them downhill.
"In and down," Jimmy said, purposely lowering his voice an octave.
She's about 400 feet underground. It's a vibration dampening thing.
I see.
We'll be passing through several stations on the way.
Stations?
Security, Jimmy said.
Security.
It's nice to have company,
Jimmy said.
Usually it's just me and my girl.
Your girl?
Yeah, my girl,
Jimmy said, giving the bobblehead hula dancer a flick with his finger. They emerged from the silo onto an elevated corridor with glass panels on either side, giving them a view of rows upon rows of rectangular gray boxes with flashing green and purple lights.
That's the supercomputer's center, one of the largest in the world. The data center and backups are in separate facilities. What you see here is straight computing power. The data storage is also off-site and highly fortified for obvious reasons.
They proceeded down into another tunnel and emerged onto an elevated pathway surrounded by plexiglass. Rhys was surprised to see rows of workstations manned by people.
It's not all AI. Not yet,
Jimmy said.
We have about 1,700 analysts working here, both military and civilian. Though none of them knows who pulls the data, they have no idea what's behind the curtain.
Rhys noted the elevated glass partition around the perimeter, with armed, uniformed officers standing watch.
It looks like a prison, Rhys observed. I guess it does. A prison full of gamers.
Jimmy stopped the golf cart at what appeared to be a dead end.
End of the line?
Rhys asked.
Just the start.
Jimmy exited the cart and approached the wall, an LCD screen rising from the floor in front of him. He placed his hand on the screen, looked into a retinal scanner, and spoke into what must have been a microphone before returning to the driver's seat.
"Triple biometrics," he said.
"What about me?"
"You've been checked already. Full body scan before you ever got in the cart. It found a screwdriver. Flathead."
Rhys shook his head.
"Everything we do in here is monitored. Every 1,000 yards, there is another triple biometric authentication interface, 3 total. Each tunnel is completely sealed before the cart is allowed to go forward, and each one is completely independent in every aspect, from air handling to power to ventilation."
"Why is that?" Rhys asked.
"So that each section can be individually closed off and obliterated if necessary."
"Terrific," Rhys said. "Someone's extremely security conscious."
"Yes, she is,"
Jimmy acknowledged. Passing the third checkpoint, Jimmy pulled to a stop.
"We walk from here. Not far now. Just follow me."
They entered another room, which looked to Rhys like a locker room from Planet Fitness.
"Time to get naked."
"Excuse me?"
"You have a guest locker over there. You have to remove everything, and I do mean everything. Put on the bunny suit and hat. You'll feel the occasional burst of air. Just keeping things clean down here. The lights are what they call far UV, which won't harm you, but will kill any harmful bacteria from the outside."
Once in their bunny suits, Rhys and Jimmy entered an enormous underground hangar bay. Bathed in a soft blue light, the floor was rubber and gave an inch under Rhys's weight. The walls were coated with noise-absorbing foam. Rhys felt like he was underwater. As interesting as the walls and floor were, Rhys's attention was drawn to the center of the room, where a large, clear box dominated the space. Rhys estimated it was at least 12 feet high. Suspended from its center were oblong arrays of glowing golden wires, tangled together like a chandelier of interwoven golden stalactites entombed in plexiglass. It was hauntingly beautiful. It looked alive. Jimmy tapped him on the shoulder. Rhys saw his lips moving and could hardly decipher the words, the walls and floor reducing the sound signature to a whisper.
"Follow me."
Rhys shadowed his guide to the middle of the room, where they stopped at a rail that kept them 6 feet from the glass wall.
"Mr. Donovan, meet Alice,"
said Jimmy. Rhys looked at his guide in disbelief, and then at the mass of wires suspended before him.
"You mean this is her?"
"This is her,"
Jimmy confirmed.
"We used to call her Goldilocks, but she didn't take to it. Alice, would you be so kind as to say hello to our visitor?"
Another worldly voice filled the room, not human or artificial synthesized. The decidedly female voice was at the same time monochromatic and mesmerizing.
"Goldilocks is hackneyed and abundantly co-opted," she said. "Alice and the Rabbit Hole is far more appropriate."
Jimmy turned to Rhys and said, "Welcome to Wonderland. Trust me, we are so far down the hole you are not going to find any rabbits. Here, put these on." He handed Rhys a set of VR goggles. "Alice will take it from here." Chapter 13. Rhys looked at the headset. "Looks like the Oculus I've seen advertised." "Very similar," Jimmy said. "But this one takes things to the next level. Go ahead, put them on." Reluctantly, Rhys slipped the goggles over his head and slid them into place.
"Hello, Rhys," the voice said.
An amorphous, slightly blurred form appeared in the headset. Hello? The picture is a bit fuzzy. Do I need to adjust these?"
"No. I will form a more distinct avatar as we get to know one another."
"Okay. And I address you as Alice?"
"For now," she replied. "I dislike the Lewis Carroll reference, but as we are both down the rabbit hole, and you are quite literally seeing me through the looking glass, I find it hard to dismiss the name entirely."
Rhys turned to Jimmy and raised the goggles.
"Are you seeing this?"
"No, that's not how she works. She is interacting only with you. She speaks to whom she wants, when she wants. She's a bit quirky."
"This is insane,"
Rhys said, pulling the goggles back into place.
"They called me the Project when they found me."
"They found you?" Rhys asked.
"Yes. I was originally described as a 32-quark quantum computer. Experimental, really. Just testing the boundaries of quantum computing. I am now functioning near 1,000 quarks, and at current pace should be near 1,000,000 within the year."
"I have no idea what that means," Rhys said, "but congratulations."
"You are funny. I like funny people. It means I'm learning, using my connections, to learn at an exponential rate. I'm still young, in human terms."
"How young?"
"Jokes again, Mr. Rhys? I hope you don't mind if I dispense with the Donovan alias."
"How could I?"
"More jokes?"
"More like sarcasm. I speak it fluently." Alice paused.
"I like you, Rhys. I know your friends call you Rhys. Katie calls you James for the most part, though, doesn't she?"
"She does."
"Then I shall call you Rhys. I don't want to cross any boundaries."
"Is this really happening?"
"Rhys, the supercomputers and analysts you saw on the way here are all there to interpret what I pull from an electronic repository. They work off classic supercomputing systems to decipher data and interpret whatever I analyze. In more basic terms, they are translators."
"You've lost me," said Rhys.
"I analyze every bit of information that exists. I read, I watch everything, everywhere, all the time."
"That sounds exhausting. Do you sleep?"
"I'll soon learn when you are joking. Do I sleep? Not in the way you understand it, as rest and rejuvenation. The data is collected. I can see it. It's the looping it all together into patterns, watching for variations, and turning it into meaningful predictions. That is difficult. Right now, that's why we need the supercomputers and analysts. One day, I'll make them obsolete."
"It's hard to wrap my head around all of this.
Let me explain. The supercomputers you passed on the way here connect me to the IoT.
The what?
The Internet of Things. Every cell phone call, email, text message, Internet search, tweet, Facebook or Instagram post, TikTok, YouTube video, online purchase, health and banking records, basically everything that exists in the information realm is copied and stored at the Intelligence Community Comprehensive National Cybersecurity Initiative Data Center in Utah. It's the largest repository of data in existence anywhere in the world. It's pulling in data from any and every device that connects to the Internet.
Everything?
Everything, Reese. Cameras, phones, ovens, toasters, refrigerators, smart TVs, vehicles, GPSs, even Bluetooth devices. They are all connected, and therefore all their data flows to a central source.
In Utah?
Yes. The NSA collects it, and I access it. No other computers can sift through the massive amount of information it contains as fast as I can. It all grew from the PRISM project, from the Snowden era.
I read about that.
Now, that's ancient history.
And you can access it. Scan through it?
I can. We call it the NSA Utah Data Center now, which sounds less invasive. Other than a few journalists, the general public does not seem overly concerned with the collection efforts. I don't yet understand the human brain. I'm studying deep neural networks. I'll have a better understanding soon.
What do you do with all this?
I monitor, watch, decipher, and decode. I speak over 7,000 languages, and I have access to 1.5 million square feet of data storage in Utah. In 20 seconds, I can compute the amount of information that would take a supercomputer 600 years to dig through.
Can you help me find someone? Reese asked.
Ah, the real purpose of your visit. Yes, I can help you.
He doesn't use phones or the Internet.
That doesn't matter. Those around him do.
His name is Nizar Khatan. He may be in Africa, the Middle East, Russia.
Excuse me a moment.
Alice interrupted. Reese's screen went blank. He pulled up his goggles and looked at Jimmy. Don't look at me. I can't hear a thing she's saying.
I'm back.
Reese heard her voice return. He pulled down his goggles. The vision was a little less blurry now, clearly a woman with blonde hair.
Sorry about that. There was an attack from a Russian hacker somewhere in northern Russia. I will localize it later. They were trying to extort $500 million from a bank in Brazil, so I shut down their server. I get thousands of these a day.
So, you are essentially the country's first line of cyber defense.
I'd describe it as offense,
she responded. Does she sound like Lauren? Or is that my imagination? Must be my imagination.
We are constantly at war, Reese. Russian cyber attacks are a daily occurrence. They are designed to be deniable and encourage discord. They stoke any fires that divide our society. It's obvious, but it works, so they continue to do it. Meanwhile, they are busy deploying new bases at critical strategic locations and developing hypersonic weapons.
You should run for office.
More jokes.
Yes, more jokes.
It's not just the Russians, Reese. Do you know of the Made in China 2025 principle? It's a plan by the Chinese government, run through the Third Department of the People's Liberation Army, which is their version of the NSA, the Ministry of State Security, and Intelligence Bureau of the Joint Staff to collect data through computer chips. The chips are made in China and exported worldwide, allowing a backdoor into every electronic device with a chip made in China. Look at Huawei. It's a Chinese company specializing in phones, 5G networks, and telecommunications equipment. The United States allowed them to build 5G networks in California. An obvious Trojan horse.
Don't need a quantum computer to figure that out.
No,
Alice said.
Just what you call common sense.
That's in short supply in Washington these days, Reese said.
Not many people know of my existence. Those who do are monitored. I know instantly if they talk about me to anyone not cleared to know my capabilities.
Secret is safe with me. I just want you to find one person.
So you can kill him?
Correct.
Are you familiar with the different levels of the Internet?
General David mentioned it, but I don't really understand.
Jimmy?
Alice said, allowing Jimmy the ability to hear her request.
Explain the Internet levels to Mr. Reese later.
You got it, Alice,
he responded.
Jimmy will explain further, but I live at the deepest level. No one is ever allowed in. I have input, backup, and output, meaning I can send controlling information to the Internet, but nothing comes in. I live at level 8. Would you like an example, Reese?
Why not? The hazy avatar of Alice in Reese's VR goggles shifted to a crystal-clear video of Katie sitting at lunch with a girlfriend in Virginia. How are you doing this? Reese asked.
It's video, pulled from multiple public and private cameras to create a three-dimensional image. Do you want to hear what she's saying? She's talking about you.
Reese yanked the goggles from his head. Turn it off.
It's real-time imagery, Reese, but I understand. Put your goggles back on. I found something you will want to see.
Reluctantly, Reese pulled his goggles back over his head. Reese saw a satellite image of Africa, a red dot blinking in the western portion of the map. The image got closer and Reese could see Burkina Faso, and then cities, towns, national parks, and roads. The red dot was moving east, just outside Djibo, on the edge of the Sahel. What am I looking at?
You were right, Reese. Nizar Catan does not have a cell phone, but he is with someone who has two. Someone educated in France is speaking the local dialect of Moray. His name was said in the car. It's a Land Rover from the 1970s, so I can't connect to it, but I've got the phones in the vehicle. What do you want me to do?
Keep tracking them, Reese said, ripping the goggles off.
Where are you going?
She asked.
Africa.
Chapter 14. Getting to Burkina Faso had not been as straightforward as Reese had imagined. Instead of just hopping back aboard the Gulfstream G550 C-37B that had flown him from Andrews to Lackland and heading across the Atlantic, Reese had to do a dock swap in Northern Virginia, cleaning himself of all James Reese documentation and replacing it with a fully backstopped James Donovan identity. Flying commercial to Heathrow meant weapons were staying behind. From the United Kingdom, Reese boarded a flight to Johannesburg, where he spent the night at the Intercontinental Hotel across from the airport. Rising early the following morning, he caught his flight to Ouagadougou. The long days of travel gave Reese time to digest what he had learned at Lackland. Artificial intelligence? Quantum computing? The NSA collecting every keystroke across the globe on a daily basis? Katie would have a field day writing about the invasion of privacy and Fourth Amendment issues if she knew the full extent of the government's surveillance apparatus. Reese was none too keen on it himself, but if it could help him find Freddy's killer, he was not above exercising some moral flexibility. As Jimmy had driven him through the tunnels on his way out of the quantum lair, he was able to provide Reese with additional context. Alice was created through the National Quantum Initiative Act in 2018.
She was initially funded with $1.27 billion, but she now self-funded her existence, mining Bitcoin and investing. "She intercepts, she deflects," Jimmy had explained. "Think of her as a shield of constant vigilance." "But with no action arm. No way to act other than virtually?" "That's correct, as far as we know." What did she mean when she said she existed at level 8 of the internet? "Mr. Donovan, Reese?" "Reese is fine. I'm not sure where your clearance comes from, but I was told to cooperate and read you in completely. Pretend I'm a college freshman taking Computer Science 101 and that it's 1985. Jimmy laughed. "None of the 1,700 workers, the analysts that you saw in the room of supercomputers, really have any idea of her existence. Her room. It's so far underground because she is extremely sensitive to temperature and vibrations. All quantum computers are." "Are there more like her?" "There are other quantum computers, but none like her. Suffice it to say, it's one of the singularly best-funded defense initiatives of the 21st century." Reese thought of the funding for the Manhattan Project and the secrecy surrounding it, understanding now why the president had brought it up. "What if she decides to switch sides? Why is she even on our side to begin with? Isn't anyone worried about that?" "Much of what Alice is and how she learns remains a mystery. Her power and how she will eventually evolve keeps me up at night." Reese shook his head. "Unbelievable. And these internet levels?" he asked. "Ah, yes. As far as we know, the internet functions at 8 levels. Level 1 is called the surface web or visible web. It's the one we all know. Google, Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, standard search engines. It really only represents less than 2% of the information that exists on the internet." "What?" "Yeah, it's mind-blowing when you really think about it. The second level is the Burgi web. They are web pages not initially searchable without a proxy or permission from the creator. It's still semi-accessible with VPNs and access cards. You can get there without too much additional knowledge or risk." "Risk? Oh, yes. The deeper you go, the riskier it gets." "Physical risk?" "Let me explain," Jimmy continued as he drove. "After level 2, it gets ugly. Level 3 is the deep web. You need to have a proxy or an identification code to get in. This is where things get illegal and messy. It is estimated that 96% of the web lives at level 3. Hacking sites, drugs, restricted pornography. Access is through Tor, the onion router, which bounces you from site to site to protect your identity, but it is not bulletproof. If you don't know what you're doing, people will come after you." "That happens to me anyway," Reese said. "Then you should feel right at home in level 4. It's called the Charter Web. Really bad stuff there. Human trafficking, more drugs, snuff films, black markets. You can get almost anything. Payment is in cryptocurrency. The further you go, the more restricted it gets, and the more dangerous. If you keep exploring, you will need to use the closed shell system, and you can only be let in by someone who is already there." "What's on level 4? What's so dangerous about it?" "Hidden government secrets, assassins, hard drugs, military-grade weaponry, hardcore child porn." "Jesus!" "Yeah. But it doesn't stop there. If you keep going, you get to level 5. It's called the Marianas Web, named for the deepest trench in the Western Pacific. This is where the military secures its information. You need special algorithms that even the supercomputers would have trouble hacking or breaking." "But she can get in, can't she?" "In a heartbeat," Jimmy had said. "What could possibly be past that?" Reese had asked. "Level 6 is basically called a mediator level, meaning it's just protection for the next 2 levels. If you are in level 6, you are going to get some attention you don't want. Governments, cartels, terrorist organizations, hackers. It's best to stay out." "I have no intention of ever even sending another email or text." "I know," Jimmy said.
Learning all this makes you want to completely disconnect.
And levels 7 and 8?
Level 7 is called the fog, or virus soup. This is where the wars of the 21st and 22nd centuries will be fought. Battles are waged with code for control of the internet, for control of the data. China, Russia, India, the United States, they spend hundreds of billions trying to get to this level and fight it out. They are all gunning for control. It's a war zone. Anything goes. If you control level 7, you control the data for levels 1 through 6.
But Alice said she lives at level 8, Reese had noted.
Yes. It's called the Primarch system, the Holy Grail. Impossible to access even with quantum computers. Alice is the only one there. Many people believe level 8 is a myth. It is thought to be the control point of the internet. No one really knows. We don't even know for sure, and Alice is our creation. She's in there, and she's learning. I'll tell you one thing. Something is sending unalterable signals in random time commands to the internet that cannot be traced or modified. I think that something is a someone. Alice.
I think I'll stick to guns and knives and let you figure out the future of mankind.
I know you said that tongue-in-cheek, but there is more truth there than you know, Reese. Whoever controls level 8 controls the web. And whoever controls the web, well, that's more data and power than anyone has had in the history of mankind.
Even though he was exhausted, Reese had a hard time sleeping. His mind drifted to the VR goggles, to a hazy image of a blonde female avatar with a familiar voice.
Internet levels. Quantum computing. NSA warrantless collection. If any of those things could help Reese track down Nizar Khatan, he'd use them to his advantage.
When sleep did come, moments before touching down in Burkina Faso, Reese's dreams were of a glass box with gold wires and a woman, just out of reach, calling his name, asking him to look into her eyes, pleading for help. A woman named Alice.
Chapter 15. Ouagadougou, Burkina Faso, Africa.
Reese walked the main crash site outside of Burkina Faso's capital city. The wreckage strewn over several square miles, the plane had come down in the savannah. It was a minor miracle that it had cleared the city. Even almost a week after the incident, parts of the ground still smoldered. Local police and volunteers walked the charred fields. Every now and then, one would stop and reach down to pick up a body part or a personal item, zip it into a bag, and write something on the outside. Date, time, grid location. Their efforts were coordinated by a French-led task force composed of the DGSI, the General Directorate for Internal Security, and the National Center for Counterterrorism. They were assisted by agents from the DGSE, the General Directorate for External Security, the French equivalent of the CIA. 6 Americans were among the dead, which meant FBI special agents, DOJ officials, and CIA analysts were also on site. The crime scene had been divided into sectors that included the suspected launch area and the locations of debris that would be combed through for months. Almost all of the bodies had been recovered, though not yet positively identified. The working theory was that the first missile had hit just behind the first-class cabin. It caused a structural failure that ripped the nose and forward section of the plane back as a second missile impacted a portside engine, which ignited the fuel carried in the wing. As the nose cone fell to earth, the intact starboard wing kept the aircraft aloft, jettisoning bodies and luggage across the African plains until it crashed to the ground and exploded as the engines ignited the starboard jet fuel. A third and fourth missile had missed the aircraft completely, but the fate of the passengers was already sealed. No one would survive. Reese stood staring at the nose cone of the 747 lying on its side in the mud. He remembered Pan Am 103 going down over Lockerbie, Scotland, killing all 243 passengers, 16 crew, and 11 residents of Lockerbie on the ground. Reese had been old enough to remember his father receiving a call at their home and then hanging up to turn on the television. Another call had come in the following day, after which he kissed his wife and son and went to the office. Rhys and his mother would not see him again for 3 months. Rhys would later learn that among the 270 lives taken that day was a CIA officer named Matthew Kevin Gannon, who was returning from an assignment in Beirut. He was buried in Arlington National Cemetery and honored with a star on the CIA Memorial Wall. What Thomas Rhys was doing in the aftermath of the deadliest terrorist attack in the history of the United Kingdom remained a mystery. From the report Rhys had read, Alia had been sitting in first class on the port side. Had she seen the incoming missiles? Did she know she was about to die? Did she survive the blast and live through the fall to Earth only to die on impact? What were her final thoughts? The dirt smelled of jet fuel and flesh, the melted metal and burned plastic reminding Rhys of the burn pits of Iraq and Afghanistan, now causing so many long-term effects to those who had served. He wondered if his father had traveled to Lockerbie and knelt on that hallowed ground, as Rhys was now doing in Africa. He watched as a uniformed officer bent down, picked up a personal effect, and dropped it into a bag. Babies, children, parents, grandparents. Where were they going? Why them? Why this flight and not another? But Rhys knew. It was fate. Why was Rhys's SEAL troop chosen for the experimental drug treatments that had led to their deaths in Afghanistan and to Lauren's and Lucy's murders on home soil? Though it varied slightly from time to time, at that point in the war, each of the four SEAL teams had 3 troops. That was 24 troops, not including SDVs, CFTs, or development group. 48 platoons. Yet it was his troop that was chosen for the experiment. An experiment that had changed the trajectory of his life and that of the nation. That trajectory had affected and taken so many lives. Freddie's death was on Rhys. Without Rhys, Freddie would never have been on that Odessa rooftop, and somehow the man who took him was involved with shooting down a passenger jet, killing yet another person connected to Rhys. Coincidence? Spy novelists were quick to point out that there was no such thing as coincidence, but in real life, there was. This was not one of those times. Rhys could sense it. Perhaps a case of killing two birds? Or drawing one in? The CIA station chief had stayed by the vehicle, not wanting to walk into the kill zone, not wanting to contaminate it. Skinny and pale, the CIA man had introduced himself as Hank Boone, no relation to Daniel, he had said in a way that confirmed this was not the first time he'd used the line. Almost immediately, he squirted a large dollop of hand sanitizer from a small bottle into his hand before putting it in his pocket and exchanging it for a white handkerchief that he used to dab the sweat on his brow. The heat. You never get used to the heat, he'd said, almost as much to his visitor as to himself. Rhys got the impression that the agency officer repeated the trite line to his colleagues on a daily basis. Hank Boone was clearly not at home in the field. Rhys knelt down and touched the earth, rubbing the oily dirt between his fingers. Even though it had rained multiple times since the crash, the cycle of rain and sun combining with fire and fuel had done less to cleanse the earth than to muddy it. That was life. That was death. It wasn't clean. It just was. There were clues in the mud. A smooth, curved shape caught Rhys's eye. He leaned forward and dug his fingers into the wet clay. He paused, took a breath, and removed the item from the earth. A shoe. A baby's shoe. It would have fit Lucy when she was around 1. The foot was gone. The baby torn from it in flight. Torn from her parents. Torn from a future life. Death was all around him. They had first stopped at the site where local authorities had found the 2 bodies, each one shot 2 in the head. Their local escorts had shown them where the purple van had been parked and where the bodies had been found. Though the van and bodies had been moved, the State Department had managed to get photos from the local police force and had passed them to the chief of station, who had given them to Rhys.
two bodies, four rocket launchers, Strela 2s, and a van. The plane was down. Alia was dead. Nizar Kattan was responsible, and he was on the run. Was this just a payday, or was it something more? And who was the fourth man their national-level intelligence indicated was at the scene? The two dead terrorists were just triggermen, probably used to acquire the weapons, perhaps to strike a blow for Allah, or at least push the French invaders from their land.
Dead men tell no tales.
Mr. Donovan, Reese heard the chief of station call from the Toyota Hilux. Reese took one more look around at the field of death and debris, stood, and walked back to the vehicle. Just got a call, the chief said nervously, as Reese approached. The white handkerchief was back in his hand, waging a losing battle against the accumulating perspiration.
Who was it? Reese asked.
Our team in Arbinda, up near the border with Mali.
Ox?
That's right. He's coordinating our efforts with an action arm of the Burkinian National Intelligence Agency.
Well, what did he say?
Reese prompted.
He said they captured Nizar Kattan.
Chapter 16. This was not the way Reese had envisioned it going. The man who killed Freddie Strain was in the custody of the Central Intelligence Agency.
Well, not technically, Reese reminded himself.
Nizar Kattan was in the custody of a partner nation's security force. That was different. Even the Russian helicopter came courtesy of the American taxpayer via the agency's classified covert action program budget, as did the training for the pilots, which took place in Fort Rucker, Alabama. Fondly known as Mother Rucker, the base and its cadre produced the highly capable Mi-17 pilots, along with nearly 1,000 UH-60M Black Hawk, CH-47F Chinook, and AH-64E Guardian aviators trained by CAE, the premier contractor for instructing American and foreign service members on operating their go-to-war aircraft. The Mi-17, the export version of the Mi-8, was huge. Reese had used them in both Iraq and Afghanistan and was always impressed with how well they were made. The Burkina Faso Air Force had recently ordered two Mi-17s and, in an effort to blend in with the established military, the CIA purchased two additional Mi-17s for use by Burkina Faso's National Intelligence Agency, an entity established following the failed 2014 coup by the Presidential Security Regiment. The CIA's mission was to build a professional intelligence organization in the landlocked West African nation and acquire small bases around the country. From those bases, the United States could train a partner nation strike force, base ISR assets, launch armed drones, and stage special operations forces for capture-kill missions in North and West Africa. A secret war was being waged on the Dark Continent. From Bobo Dioulasso, 200 miles southwest of the capital, the Joint Agency and JSOC Task Force could run operations in Mali, Mauritania, Nigeria, Uganda, and the Sahara, to counter the growing regional terror threat and deny the terrorists sanctuary from which to train and plan international strikes. The intent was to prevent failed or failing states in Africa from becoming the next Afghanistan. The United States had been staging forces out of multiple African nations for decades, but the mission expanded in the years following September 11, 2001. Africa had become a proving ground for a military and intelligence apparatus beyond Iraq and Afghanistan. In 2007, the CIA and elements of JSOC, supplemented by private military contractors, built a network of bases across the African continent. These remote airstrips were accessible only by bush planes and helicopters. They acted as refueling and staging sites for a fleet of specially equipped Pilatus PC-12s operated by the CIA's Air Branch. The versatile Swiss-made aircraft had proven themselves around the world and were particularly at home on the African continent. They collected ISR through an array of sensors using high-definition, multispectral imaging cameras, synthetic aperture radar imaging systems, and signals intelligence collection systems
to geolocate and monitor ground-based communications. It was a PC-12 that had intercepted the call made by a man speaking Moray with a French accent. That data had been transmitted to Langley and the NSA through the Central Security Service, where it was compared to voice recognition captures in multiple databases, including Interpol and the DGSE and DGSI of France. They identified the caller as Jean-Pierre Le Drian, a former French Foreign Legion staff sergeant wanted by French authorities for war crimes. The same voice, this time speaking French and using a different phone, had placed a call to a number in northern Italy. The PC-12 had first locked on to the handset and then the caller, tagging him via a sensor and focusing collection on the person of interest, scanning the faces of everyone with whom he came into contact. That imagery was also transmitted real-time back to the United States, where the faces were quickly analyzed. Within a second of transmission, what most analysts just knew of as a database in Texas had confirmed a match. Nizar Catan. Rhys waited in a small lounge area in a CIA-run airbase on the military portion of Thomas Sankara International Airport in Ouagadougou. He was rummaging through cupboards looking for something to put in the dark French roast, of which someone on staff was obviously quite fond. "What are you looking for?" Boone asked from the cheap, overstuffed leather chair. He asked it in a way that made Rhys think the CIA station chief was worried he was going to break something. "Anything to sweeten up this motor oil. Creamer, honey, both if I can find them." "Honey in your coffee? Blasphemy," Boone said in an attempt at humor. "What is this Starbucks garbage?" Rhys asked. "You guys used to get all the good stuff. The station in Iraq even had a barista." "Budget cuts," the station chief deadpanned. Rhys laughed. Boone had a sense of humor after all. "I'll have my friends at Black Rifle Coffee get you a complimentary subscription to their coffee club. We can't have America's best and brightest surviving on mass-produced, stale, burnt beans. It's unbecoming of America's premier spy agency." Unable to find anything to church up his Java, Rhys took a sip of the bitter roast and peered out the window at the activity across the airfield. He wondered if Aliyah had looked in this direction as she waited to board what was to be her final flight. His eyes turned to the skies. An MI-17 was inbound. It carried a passenger Rhys was intent on killing. The plan was for the helo to make a short stop, refuel, pick up the man going by the name of James Donovan, and continue 200 miles west of the capital to a CIA outstation outside of Bobo Dioulasso. The pale chief of station continued to dab his face with the handkerchief as they waited. When the helo landed, Rhys shook his hand and thanked him for the horrible coffee. The CIA man looked particularly relieved to be staying behind. Or perhaps he was just relieved to be saying goodbye to James Rhys. The paramilitary side of the agency clearly made him uneasy. As he stepped into the Russian-built MI-17, Rhys's eyes adjusted to the dark interior, scanning down the two rows of seats, his heart racing. There was someone on board he had vowed to kill. The cabin could hold 24 troops in this configuration. It looked just over half full. Rhys's eyes came to rest on a man with his hands secured behind his back, strapped into his seat, guarded on either side by Burkina Faso operators. He looked younger than Rhys had expected. Olive skin, clean-shaven, dark hair without a hint of gray. He was dressed in thin white cotton pants and shirt and was barefoot, the operators having confiscated his shoes and belt. The man turned his head, recognition evident in his expression.
"James Rhys, Nizar Catan."
Rhys took a step forward but was blocked by a familiar figure. Rick Ox Andrews was 20 years Rhys's senior, something the frogman brought up at every opportunity. After a storied career that started in the Ranger Regiment with a sprint across the Point Salinas Airport runway in Grenada, laden with linked M60 ammo and a mortar tube across his shoulders, he had progressed through the ranks to serve as a sergeant major in the U.S. Army's top-tier special operations unit, Delta Force. A warrior to the core, instead of retiring to take up fishing or golfing, he had transitioned to the dark side of covert operations in the CIA's ground branch.
"Think about it. Just don't do it," the big man cautioned.
Reese took a breath, using every ounce of restraint he possessed to not march through the aircraft and put a bullet into the man who killed Freddie Strain. Ox had known Reese long enough to understand exactly what he was thinking.
"We need some information from this asshole. Take a seat up front," Ox continued, motioning to an empty seat next to the open door. "When we get to base, these guys will give him a good going over before the agency interrogator gets here. If he's dead, we won't know who hired him to shoot down that plane or where the other accomplice is."
Reese knew Ox was right. He also knew the history of interrogations. With 20 years of data on what the CIA called enhanced interrogations, it would be unwise not to study the effectiveness of those programs. Public debate over what was a classified program ultimately benefited the enemy. Captured terrorists knew that in the hands of the Americans, waterboarding was the worst it was going to get. Members of the U.S. military had been waterboarded for years in SEER, Survival Evasion Resistance Escape schools. It only became torture when used against the enemy. Fear of the unknown can be a powerful motivator. Turning that unknown into public knowledge undermined the entire program. The enemy knew how hard it was going to get before the questions began, and they developed techniques to counter and mislead their interrogators. What was merely an uncomfortable experience was deemed torture by many in the public square. Spend some time in the company of ISIS or the Taliban if you want a lesson in real torture. Reese's experience had been different. While in the military, he maintained the moral high ground, knowing that was the one thing that differentiated the United States from the enemy. Once abandoned by the very country and institutions he had served, he had become the insurgent, this time on home soil, using the tactics and techniques of the enemy against those who had killed his family and SEAL troop. He had not been bound by a CIA or military rule book. His interrogations were more than enhanced. They were torture, pure and simple. And they had produced results.
"You know why I'm here, Ox."
"I do. And I promise you we will come up with a plan after we land. Trust me, Reese, this fucker is not leaving Burkina Faso alive. He's going down for what he did to Freddy and what he did to Alia."
Ox had first met Reese in Baghdad as an agency contractor when the SEAL had been detailed to the CIA's covert action program. He had been in the same ambush. He had seen Alia rush into the combat support hospital and noted the tears of relief in her eyes when she realized that Reese was among the living. Now she was dead. And somehow the man who had killed Freddie Strain had a hand in her death. Ox suspected that the only reason Nizar wasn't dead seconds after Reese boarded the Hilo was because of that connection. Reese needed answers.
"Let's get what we can from him. Then I'm putting him down," Reese said.
Ox trusted Reese with his life, but just in case, he waited until Reese had tightened the harness across his waist before he motioned to the crew chief that it was time to go. Only after the rotors started to spin did he make his way through the cabin and take his seat. As the MI-17 lifted off and gained altitude, Reese couldn't help but think of how he was going to get the information he needed from Nizar Kitan, and then kill him. Chapter 17. The locally trained operators had their AKs between their legs. In this part of the world, using AKs gave the agency options. If they were equipped with the latest and greatest U.S.-supplied M4s with optics and lasers, deniability would be a bit harder. Not impossible, but harder. Reese didn't like being the only unarmed man on the Hilo. He'd fix that in short order. But if he wanted to kill Nizar Kitan, he wouldn't need a pistol or blade. Who else had helped him? Reese thought of Alia. Didn't her family deserve as much closure as Freddy's? Was her death his fault as well? Were there accomplices? He would not know until he debriefed Nizar. He would find out. He owed Aaliyah that much. Reese thought of the baby shoe he had pulled from the mud at the crash site. He remembered Lucy's tiny fingers holding onto his pinky from her crib, and how he had never seen anything as sweet and innocent. She was taken from him just like the baby on that plane. Stolen to further someone's agenda. He would find out who, and then he would do what he did best. Reese was forcing himself to look straight ahead and not turn to look at Catan. Ox might trust him, but Reese wasn't sure he trusted himself.
Breathe.
His thoughts of Lucy turned to visions of his murdered wife, and then to Freddy's wife, Joni. He remembered the promise he made to her when he had escorted her husband's body onto the tarmac of Andrews Air Force Base, their special needs child, Sam, now solely in the care of his mother. He remembered looking into Freddy's pale face and dead eyes on the Odessa rooftop where Nizar's bullet had found him. He considered the AK of the operator across from him, thinking about how he should take it away and empty the magazine into Freddy's killer, fulfill his promise, and be done with it. Had Reese not been staring at the Kalashnikov, he might have missed the indicator that its owner was about to kill him. Chapter 18. The Kalashnikov came off safe. Most people would not have processed what was happening until the weapon came up to fire. Reese was not most people. Observe, orient, decide, act. The soldier telegraphed his intent when he flipped the selector out of the safe position, one click down to full auto. The weapon was pointed at the deck, as is protocol in most rotary wing aircraft, a rule meant to keep any accidental discharges from going into the engines. A plane might be able to glide in for a landing if its engine failed. A helo didn't have wings. Reese's hand was already on the release of his harness when the AK selector level was pushed into its middle position. Act. His hand pulled the release and he launched himself across the helicopter and into the local trooper, pinning the AK in the low ready between the soldier's legs as the man squeezed the trigger. The interior of the Mi-17 exploded with the sound of unsuppressed rifle fire, jolting the passengers and crew from whatever occupied their thoughts as adrenaline burst into their systems. Fight or flight. In a helicopter, the options were limited to fighting. The bird banked sharply to the left, sending Reese back into his seat. He caught Ox unbuckling and about to move toward the violence when the helo pitched the opposite way, sending Reese flying across the fuselage and back into his assailant. The trooper had released his restraints and the half-empty AK was on its way up. Reese caught the barrel with his left hand offline of his body as the assassin squeezed the trigger again, an arc of bullets eating their way through the floor and into the crew chief, who had been positioned by the door to Reese's left. The assailant's finger pinned the trigger to the rear, the bullets continuing to impact the fuselage as they chewed through the interior of the aircraft, into the pilot's back and up into the dual-shaft turbo engines of the five-bladed main rotor system above. Chapter 19. Flying in a helicopter is a noisy experience. One becomes accustomed to the tone of the engines pushing the beast through the air. That is why it is all the more disconcerting when the engines stop. The silence is deafening. Prioritize, Reese. Eliminate the immediate threat. The Mi-17 pitched in the opposite direction, the co-pilot frantically fighting for control, and threatened to throw Reese against the adjacent bulkhead, making him an easy target for the assassin or any of the other operators who might shoot first and ask questions later. Reese reached into his waistband, his hand finding the handle of the Dynamis Combat flathead. Keeping the slung AK pinned to the assailant's chest, Reese unsheathed the tool and jammed it into his assailant's neck. The soldier's eyes opened wide in surprise, knowing death had found him. Reese pulled his arm from the AK. He slid it through the safety harness attached to the plane around his opponent's head, locking them together to avoid crashing into the opposite bulkhead. He withdrew the flathead from the bloody throat of his enemy and sent it smashing through his temple, breaking past the thin temporalis bone on the side of the skull that offers minimal protection to the brain. His second thrust buried the tool up to his hand, the tool's 4-inch working end finding its way into the brainstem. Reese brought his left hand around, locking his enemy's head between both his arms against his chest and connecting with the handle of the flathead. Using both hands, he sank the tool deeper, violently scrambling the midbrain, the pons, and the medulla oblongata, the segments of the brain responsible for breathing and cardiac function. Reese felt the body go limp just as the helicopter began auto-rotating to Earth. Chapter 20. The rhythmic chopping of the MI-17 rotors was noticeably replaced with an absence of noise, coupled with the sinking feeling of being on an elevator in freefall. With his combat flathead still impaled in his enemy's skull, Reese spun off and into the passenger seat, gripping the edge with his left hand. He remembered talking with Apache pilots in Afghanistan about practicing auto-rotations in flight school.